bill to be is House Bill 2295 as amended. Dennis.
House Bill 2295A permits winery licensee to ship to residents of Oregon not more than 2 cases of hard cider per month for personal use. Allows winery licensee to ship to residents outside of Oregon not more than 2 cases of cider per month for personal use as well. There's no revenue impact, no fiscal impact.
All right, very good. Roger, come on up. We have a couple of witnesses, Roger and Richard. Please come up. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming today, and please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Roger Mansfield. I live at 1720 Southwest Jericho Lane in the beautiful and scenic community of Culver, Oregon. Today I'm here on behalf of my winery, which is the traditional company, as well as two other wineries, Ford Farm Cider Works, as well as White Oak Cider. And I'd like to introduce Rich Ford, who is the owner of Ford Farm Cider Works, who's here to my left. Alan Foster, who's the owner of White Oak Cider, was supposed to be here. I don't know whether he got caught up in traffic, but he's on his way. Collectively, the three of us are the major producers of cider in the state of Oregon, and we're here today to request your support and approval of House Bill 2295, which would allow the direct shipment of cider under the same terms and conditions as any other wine produced in the state of Oregon. And for those of you who may not be familiar with cider, cider under the U.S. Code of Federal Regulations is defined as a fruit wine made from fermented apple or pear juice, and the alcohol content is usually about under 7%, which makes it about half of what a normal grape wine would be. In order to make cider in the state of Oregon, it requires a federal winery license as well as the state of Oregon winery license, and there are three primary producers, the traditional company, Ford Farm Cider Works, and White Oak Cider. And all three of us are relatively small wineries. We're family run. We also grow our own apples and pears to make our truly world-class ultra-premium ciders. And under current Oregon law, we have a number of problems with our ability to sell our product. There are a lot of people all over the world who would like to buy our cider, but we can't sell it to them. And the first problem we have is we're precluded from shipping cider to residents in the state of Oregon. The law is discriminatory against fruit wine producers that want to make cider. With a winery license, we can actually make a fruit wine made out of just about anything you want to name: rhubarb, bananas, raspberries, olala berries, you name it. But if we want to make it out of apples or pears, we can't do it and ship it to a resident in Oregon. That creates a bit of a problem. Second of all, we also have a situation where Oregon law really favors out-of-state cider producers over Oregon producers. Under our reciprocal wine shipping laws, a producer, for example, in Washington State or California, because their states consider cider wine, and because under our reciprocal laws we can ship back and forth, they regularly do send their ciders to residents of Oregon who were precluded from shipping our products to. So it's favoring out-of-state producers over Oregon producers. And third, we're not able to ship to out-of-state consumers. For example, if we wanted to send it to a consumer in Washington or California, we can't do it. So we're at a economic disadvantage. We're losing out on sales and marketing opportunities by the current law. And we feel that there's a solution to that problem, which is House Bill 2295, as amended by the House, which once again would allow the direct shipment within the state and out of the state, as is permitted for any other wine produced in Oregon. In conclusion, we feel that the state of Oregon has an opportunity to level the playing field with respect to cider, and we would request that you support and endorse and approve House Bill 2295 as amended, which would once again give us those same benefits as any other wine produced in the state. And we're happy to respond to any questions that you might have.
Okay, very good. Richard, do you want to?
I'm the owner of Ciderworks. My wife and I have a small orchard on Savvy's Island just north of Portland. And we started manufacturing cider product, which is 7% and less in alcohol content, about 5 years ago. And as of 2 years ago, we're licensed and bonded and approved by OLCC and secured the winery license under the BATF. And really, we're pretty much naive or didn't even, we're not aware of this restriction until Roger notified us about 6 months ago. So I pretty much endorse everything that he has said. It's tough enough right now to the economic climate and the agricultural climate to make a dollar, and it seems to me unfair that the legislation currently allows wineries to ship in-state and out-of-state, but that a cider producer cannot, particularly when you look at a 7% versus up to 14 or 15% for wine. So I think it's something, as I reviewed the paperwork, it almost looks like it was an oversight.
Wow.
So I'm here to endorse it. And Alan was supposed to be here. He called me from Canby and said I'm running a little late, which is typical, but he also would endorse this bill. And he's actually the first commercial cider producer in the state. He started in 1984. And so hopefully he'll show up.
So it's two cases. What are the case? 12 bottles, 24?
Yeah. 12 bottles, two case, 750 milliliter.
And, I mean, there's three producers now. Does this look like it's an industry that's going to explode and you're going to have 100 producers?
Well, I think there's certainly an opportunity. This has some relevance to the wine industry, and I think what it does is it opens up the door to anybody else who might want to get into the cider production.
Yeah, I would agree with that, and it's probably much following the pattern and trend that allowed the microbrewer brewing business to evolve in the state of Oregon, mm-hmm. and then transcend into Washington. With the restrictions that you have in front of us right now, I would say that it's probably going to be limited to three now, and at the end of 2 or 3 years, there'll be nobody doing it, because if you can't make a dollar, why do it? A lot of people have hobby wineries. Of the three of us, this is not a hobby.
Yeah. Any questions? Senator Weiss.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The staff measure summary that came over from the House said there are 5 commercial producers of cider in Oregon. Are you saying there are only actually 3?
Well, I'm only aware of 3. Maybe there are maybe 5 that are registered, but maybe aren't actually producing yet.
Okay.
Well, the only other one, Widmer Brothers, at one time actually made a cider, but because of a lack of interest, they are getting out of the cider business. So I don't know who
the other one. Yeah, that's right. The other one is Mike McMiniman's brother. McMiniman's Brothers Brewing. They have brew pubs all over the state. I think they're 44, and they basically were doing this to supplement their spirits business and mm-hmm. their microbrewery business, selling it through their distribution channels. So this probably doesn't even affect them. That's why Mike's not here. They sell their product through their retail establishment.
Mm-hmm. The restaurants and bars.
And you are too small to do that.
We don't have restaurants or bars. Ours are, you know, all sold through commercial or retail establishments, you know, wine shops, restaurants, those type of things.
Mm-hmm.
That's who our primary customers are. However, there is a lot of demand for our product from outside of the state as well as within the state. And because we're relatively small, we have some problems as far as even getting and maintaining distributors mm-hmm. who will handle it. And so I think, you know, as we look down the road, as there's the roll-up of the distributors throughout the United States, the small producers are going to get further and further down on the rung of importance. And we do have to have that ability, just like any other winery in the state currently has, to ship directly to a consumer. And that's what we're asking for.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just out of curiosity, Is cider something you would drink like a glass of wine with your meal? Or?
Absolutely.
You would.
And actually, it has a history going back thousands of years. And actually, in the United States, it was probably the most popular drink in the United States up until the 1850s. It was the favorite drink of George Washington, John Adams, most of the early American presidents, down to the working man. It was the drink of choice, as I say, until about the 1850s.
And I think part of the confusion about the terminology cider as a category is a result of the larger brewing companies manufacturing what they call a, quote, cider. And basically it's made from a concentrate that they would buy from fruit, much like a fruit juice, and then they fortify it and infuse it with CO2, fructose, mm-hmm. sugar, and alcohol, and have come out with, you've probably seen them on the shelf next to beer, these very inexpensive fruit drinks. And we're not doing that. We're doing a very low alcohol handmade product that has a little bubble to it most of the time that would be served with appetizers or with a dinner. I think what you were leading up to is that the inquiries we're getting are from, you know, Chicago, New York, San Francisco, that are probably a little bit more advanced in the culinary field than we are, and they understand the category, so we can't ship to them.
Well, I hope we can change that.
Any more questions?
Thank you.
Nope. Good. Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate you coming down. We'll go into a work session on this bill.
Thank you.
Get it, please. Close the public hearing. Open up a work session on House Bill 2295 as amended. Chair would move that we send. Well, is there any discussion on 2295?
Mr. Chair, I missed the first part of it. Was there any talk or mention of emergency clause? This bill is drafted, but won't affect until January 4th or January 1st of next year.
There was no.
I don't know how that affects their selling season or if it does or not.
We didn't talk about any emergency clause. I guess we decided that making it a wine is not. It's not
an emergency.
Not an emergency.
It's not an emergency.
It's someone's livelihood. It's
someone's livelihood. Potential, but I don't know. You want to look at that to change it?
The drafters didn't indicate they needed one, so.
Okay. I'm.
You guys have any sense about that? Come on. Just an emergency bill. Well, we'll let
the expert.
Please introduce yourself.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Gary Conkling, here representing the Oregon wine growers as well as my colleagues here in the cider wine business. When the bill was originally drafted, it didn't include an emergency clause, though I don't know that we would have any objection to adding one. If I understood correctly the question, this privilege, the sooner it's available, would be more advantageous for these clients. It would slow down your process today because you would have to amend it, unless you're able to amend it conceptually to do that. I don't know if you're able to do that or not.
I would see Mr. Chamong saying, no, we don't do conceptuals.
I didn't think so at this stage. So, it's not a subject that had come up. And when it was originally drafted, it obviously didn't have it on there.
Fair.
Yes, sir.
The only reason I asked, I should have asked from you in my office, Gary, but I don't know what your selling season is and if you have product right now that is available to be sold, but this bill won't go into effect. This law would not go into effect until January 1st of next year.
Well, to answer your question,
sure.
We have product in our storage room. We'll have our harvested crop from 2002.
Sir, I can't hear you. Can you speak up?
Oh, sorry. We have product currently in the warehouse and would like to be able to continue to sell that out of state and in state direct. And we have last year's apple crop fermenting currently, and that will come online in October of this year.
Mm-hmm. So can we put an emergency clause in here, Mr. J?
When do you meet next?
Wednesday. We can do it? Okay, I mean, that would
then it has to go back to the House for concurrence if we pass it.
Well, it'd have to. Yeah.
Right. I don't think that would be, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I don't think that would be a problem to get the House committee and the floor discussion suggested they were eager to have this bill pass. And, I mean, it's a very thoughtful suggestion. So we would accept if you want to amend the bill in that case.
Okay. You folks don't have to come back on Wednesday if you don't want to.
This is Alan. He just made the trip, so maybe he should introduce himself.
And Alan, while you're here.
The open public.
Well, we've closed. I mean, just go ahead. We'll just have a quick testimony. We're doing a work session, and we're basically going to pass a bill out. We're thinking about amending it to make an emergency clause so you have an immediate right to sell it.
Oh, that would be wonderful. My name is Alan Foster, and I own White Oak Cider in Newburgh, Oregon. And I'd like to thank the committee for their time. And since I'm kind of out of the loop, I'm sure Roger will fill me in, but I'm sure they've stated that the way the law is written, it is somewhat of an impediment for those of us trying to compete in the market as the law stands. And hopefully you'll see fit to amend it in such a way that we can actually compete with other cider makers and wineries and whatnot in the marketplace.
So that's our intent, so that's what we're going to do. But
thank you very much.
We'll work on this amendment and then bring this back for a work session on Wednesday. And you folks don't have to come back. You've convinced the committee that we're ready. If you want to come back, it's fine. We'll just pass it out as amended and put an emergency clause on it and make it effective immediately.
Thank you.
Thank you. Close the work session. Open up a public hearing on 2231. Mr. Dodson.
House Bill 2321 makes technical changes to statutes relating to organizations and insignia. It's no revenue impact, no fiscal impact.
Okay. Yes.
Mr. Chair, members, Greg Chamov, Legislative Council, relative to the bill that you just heard, you don't need to submit any kind of paperwork to get the amendment. I've made the note, and we'll make sure that you get it in time for your hearing on Wednesday.
Thank you.
Each session after you adjourn, we go through the business of blending the laws that you've passed into the state's permanent code. From time to time, we find glitches in the law. If we can fix the glitch without actually changing the substance of the law, we do that in the revisers bill. That was Senate Bill 81 that you passed out earlier this session. If the idea isn't particularly controversial, but does in fact make some sort of a change in the law, we bring the glitches to you to fix in separate bills. This is one of the separate bills. The part of House Bill 2321 that's important, to the extent any part of it is important, is Section 3. That amends ORS 649090, which is originally adopted in 1933, allowed the Secretary of State to collect fees for any document filed under this chapter. You've had distributed to you a copy of ORS 649.070, which shows that in some circumstances a person may file something with the county clerk. Presumably, you didn't intend for the Secretary of State to collect a fee for a document that someone files with the county clerk, so the change in this bill limits the Secretary of State's authority to charging fees for documents filed with the Secretary of State.
Does it reduce the fees? It doesn't reduce the fees. It just limits their ability.
Mr. Chair, it does not affect the fees at all.
Any questions?
Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Greg. I appreciate you coming up. Any other witnesses signed up for this? I didn't see any. Nope.
It's not as exciting as Senate Bill 81.
Yeah, I know. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2321. Open up a work session on 2321. Comments from the committee. Chair would move House Bill 2321 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any comments on that? Any objections? So ordered. Who wants to carry this? You want me to carry this?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll do it. Awesome. Okay. Close public hearing, the work session. Open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 235. Mr. Dodson.
Senate Bill 235 establishes standards governing transaction of insurance by depository institutions and affiliates. It requires depository institution and affiliate transacting insurance to make specified disclosure to customers. Prohibits advertising or promotion that indicates governmental responsibility or guarantee of insurance products. Requires separation of credit, insurance documents, and records. No revenue impact, no fiscal impact.
Wow, this is, we got seven witnesses for here.
What?
I'm going to do this. We'll just go in the order that you're here. Joel, is it Joel?
No. Ariel.
Okay, Ariel and...
had him in judiciary.
Okay, good. Welcome. Joel, please introduce yourself.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joel Ariel. I'm the insurance administrator for the state of Oregon. With me today is Lewis Littlehales, who's our legislative counsel. The bill you have in front of you, Senate Bill 235, is a bill sponsored by the insurance division. The intent of the bill is to clarify certain consumer protections that apply in a fairly narrow context. The context here is banks involved in the sale of insurance. That is something that's been going on in Oregon since 1987. We were one of the first states to allow banks to sell insurance. The national scene on this has changed considerably in the last couple years because the federal government in the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act opened up bank sales of insurance in all states. And so what this bill does is tries to reconcile some of the law that had developed in Oregon prior to that national act with new standards in the National Act for Bank Sales of Insurance. We worked very closely with the stakeholders on this bill, both the insurance agents who have real concerns about banks using their leverage with their other product sales to unfairly be involved in the insurance marketplace, and then on the other side, the banks being concerned that the legislature not have laws that unduly hamper or restrict their ability to be involved in the insurance business. Again, we've worked out these issues pretty well in Oregon since 1987. Many of the consumer protections which are now authorized by federal law already were part of Oregon law through various legislative enactments. And what this bill tries to do is simply reword those consumer protections to be within the federal authorized standards. This has been an issue of litigation in several other states, and so following as closely as we can, the federal guidelines on this matter, we think will serve everybody's interest, and we have both the insurance agents and the banks agreeing with us on that. I'll come back at the conclusion of my testimony and talk about one narrow issue that I think generates your six other witnesses, or at least several of the other witnesses. There's one issue that the banks and the agents will want to present to the committee and have the committee consider, but other than that, we have the support of both groups through a lot of working group meetings and so forth. What the bill then does in the specific terms is, in the federal law, there are 13 safe harbors that are carved out of the federal law, and on these points, the federal law says if states have these 13 consumer protections or any subset of them, they will be okay under federal law. They will not be legally challengeable. Outside of those 13 safe harbors, states can do more consumer protection work, but anything else will be subject to a legal test, and the legal test is that it not, quote, prevent or significantly interfere with a bank's ability to be involved in the insurance market. Those are not the most precise words in the English language, prevent or significantly interfere, and it's those words which have given rise to litigation in other states, and those words which we're trying to avoid litigation on here in Oregon. So what we do in the bill, and this is on page 2 of the written testimony, if you look to the bottom of our test, bottom of page 2, you'll see the bulleted items there. They list, they summarize there the safe harbors, the 13 federal safe harbors. We've condensed them down to, I think, 7 bullet points that we put into Oregon law. Again, most of this is already Oregon law in slightly different wording, and we're just adhering as strictly as we can to the language that the federal government has authorized. They're basically in two types of areas. One is to avoid sort of anti-tying provisions, to avoid a bank which is giving somebody a loan or otherwise giving them some kind of financial product from saying, gee, I'm only going to sell you this financial product or give you this loan if you'll also buy insurance for me at the same time. And the provisions, number of them go to saying, can't do that. Those are independent transactions. Can't tie them together in that sort of way. And then the second issue is a disclosure one to the consumer. Banking products, by and large, are guaranteed kind of products. A deposit is a federally guaranteed vehicle, and insurance products, by and large, are not. Do not come with those same guarantees. So somebody, say an elderly citizen, is oftentimes the concern here that switching from a certificate of deposit where they get a certain guaranteed rate of return, assuming the federal government stays solvent, that investment is solid, now exchanging it for an annuity, an insurance product that could come with a fair amount of risk to it. That person should understand that they may get a better return, but they are also taking on more risk to get that return. And so there are a number of provisions that go to making sure that people there's full disclosure here, and people understand when they're switching from a banking product to an insurance product. And I can answer questions on anything else that's on that list as well.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
What about credit scoring, Mr. Arroyo? Do you address that here?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, I hope you're as happy as I am to say, no, we don't address credit scoring in this particular piece of legislation.
Thanks.
In fact, it says, Senator Walker, that you know that if you decline certain insurance things, it will not affect your credit and other things. You know, so it's really good.
Any other questions here?
Mr. Chairman, that's the easiest set of questions I've yet had on credit scoring, but
that's another committee, right? It's a judiciary committee.
Yes, sir. Okay. To just conclude, I'm now on the third page of the testimony, if you're following that. The outside of the 13 safe harbors, there are some provisions in Oregon law that that don't fit within the safe harbors and that we did not strike out of the bill. Our theory in the bill was anything that related to the safe harbors, we wanted to rework and turn into safe harbor language, and any other language in the statutes which was directly in conflict with safe harbor language, we removed. But any other consumer protections that the legislature had previously passed, not in direct conflict, we originally proposed to take out of the Oregon statutes, but in consultation with both the insurance agents and the banking lobby, they made, I think, the valid point that those measures were put in there by prior legislative decision, and they aren't, strictly speaking, illegal today. They're simply subject to this prevent or significantly interfere test, and so on that basis, we left those provisions in. And there's, to my knowledge, full agreement among the parties in favor of leaving all of them in except the one that you're going to hear about, and the one is this. It requires that a person who's a loan officer for the bank cannot also be an insurance agent. So it basically requires the bank to have two different people if they want to do both loans and insurance products. The banking interests have argued that that's crosses that line, that that's too restrictive and will make it difficult for them and has made it difficult for them to do certain kinds of transactions, and you'll hear from them on that point. The insurance agents will talk to you about how without that protection they won't be able to ensure that there isn't coercive tying sort of practices, and that's one that we will leave to the committee. We agreed with both parties that we wouldn't take a position on that. That's an issue that that you can consider and decide whether you want that in or out. And if you don't decide to leave it in, it may be subject to litigation later. It may not. So that's the issue that you're going to hear from the parties on. There was we have three amendments, and I understand that they didn't come through yet in LC. You have not seen them yet. So I'll briefly describe them conceptually. I guess that means the bill will need to stay another session here. But the three amendments are relatively narrow and technical in scope. The first one of them has to do with what kind of activity a banking official can do that is not a licensed insurance agent. So we're dealing with somebody like behind the counter now who doesn't hold an insurance license, and the original language of the bill was a little imprecise on what could be done, and so what we simply did was to quote the language from our own agent statutes as to what somebody who is not licensed can do. They cannot solicit, negotiate, or sell insurance. So we simply put the same rule on a banking official in that context that we put on anybody else who where the the question arises of when have you done enough insurance business that you have to have an insurance license. The Second Amendment is even more technical in nature. There's some language in one of the sections that has to do with when disclosures have to be given. I guess it would be Section 3 of the bill, Lou?
Yes.
Section 4 of the bill. And there were several points where it was a little ambiguous as to at what point in the selling process did this disclosure have to take place. And the amendment clarifies that it's prior to sale, not at some earlier point in the transaction, but simply prior to sale. And then finally, with respect to one of the disclosure requirements, there was a requirement that not only should there be disclosure to the consumer of the risk that they may take on with an insurance product, but also the requirement that there be a signed acknowledgement form from the consumer saying, I got the disclosure, and I acknowledge that I got the disclosure. That was not required under the safe. That is not part of the safe harbor language, and so we removed that language because we thought, A, it's not part of the safe harbor, and B, it's not really necessary for consumer protection. You have the requirement that there be the disclosure. So to have a second piece of paper simply acknowledging that the disclosure was received, we thought was a kind of regulation that could be described as unnecessary and burdensome, and so we took it out. And those are the three amendments. Finally, one other issue, and I don't know if Mr. Cosgrove has signed up today or not, but he had a client who had a concern that if you turn to page 2 of the bill, under sub K, it talks about how you can't sell insurance. A sale of insurance can't be done in the same documents as a financial transaction. This is sub K, line 43 on page 2 of the bill. Somebody was concerned that that language would mean that you couldn't finance an insurance product in the same document as a loan was being given. Say, so somebody buys a piece of property, they're taking out a mortgage, getting a loan for it, and they want to finance in their homeowner insurance as part of that transaction. That's not what this provision is intended to address. And so, rather than inflict another amendment on the committee, the party in concern here agreed that if we put on the record that that's not the intent of that provision, that would satisfy their interest. So that provision is not intended to prevent financing of an insurance product through a loan document. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'll conclude my testimony, and I'd be happy to answer any questions on any topic other than credit scoring.
Mm-hmm. All right, any questions from the committee? Any issues, any problems? Joel, thank you.
Thank you.
You want to testify, sir?
No, thank you, sir.
Okay, good deal. Okay. Ken Sherman and Tim Martinez, Oregon Bankers. Welcome, gentlemen. Please introduce yourself.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. It's nice to appear before you. I think this is the first time this session I've had that opportunity. Sitting to my right is Ken Sherman, Jr., the Oregon Bank Association General Counsel for many, many years. I always get a little nervous when your counsel brings a book with him. I'm not sure if he plans on reading that while he testifies, or maybe that's going to help him answer questions. I'd just like to commend Mr. Ario for his testimony. We have been working with DCBS for probably close to 8 or 9 months now on this issue. The Gramm-Leach-Bliley legislation in Congress clearly was an effort at the federal level to open up banking and insurance and securities and real estate all in one big happy family. Well, we have one issue before you today so we can get the family happy and working together, and that is the issue that Joel talked about. With that, I'll turn it over to Ken and be happy to answer any questions when he's finished.
Hi, Jim. Welcome.
Thank you, Jim. Mr. Chairman, I'm Ken Sherman, Jr. I'm general counsel for the Oregon Bankers Association, and I think it was 16 years ago that I sat here and testified before this and other committees of the, I think it was the 64th session of the legislature, in support of something called House Bill 2451, which was enacted by the 1987 legislature as Chapter 916, and which made Oregon one of the first states in the nation to allow banks to be licensed as insurance agents. A review of the legislative history of that bill shows that one of the primary motivations for the passage of that bill was to open up the insurance marketplace and to allow banks to become true one-stop shopping centers for financial products and services. 12 years later, in 1999, Congress and the rest of the country finally started catching up with Oregon when they passed what Mr. Ariel referred to as the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act, and that act, among other things, created federal authority for banks to get involved in the sale of insurance. In Graham-Leach-Bliley, Congress created a framework within which the states could regulate insurance activities by banks. They said, and I'd like to quote, "No state may by statute, regulation, order, interpretation, or other action prevent or significantly interfere with the ability of a depository institution or affiliate to engage directly or indirectly in any insurance sales, solicitation, or cross-marketing activity." The Act goes on to state some exceptions, and I again quote, "A state may impose any of the following restrictions or restrictions that are substantially the same but no more burdensome or restrictive than those in the following clauses." And then they list what Mr. Ariel referred to as the 13 safe harbors. Senate Bill 235 is designed to bring Oregon statutes into compliance with Graham-Leach-Bliley and with the safe harbor provisions. For the most part, with the amendments that are offered or will be presented by the department, we think the bill does a good job and we support its passage. But there's one significant problem with the bill in our view, one area in which its effort to bring Oregon law into compliance with the safe harbor provisions falls short. The 1987 law that granted insurance powers to banks contains a provision which was repeated in several places throughout the Bank Act, and the substance of that provision is that if a bank or an affiliate of a bank wants to sell insurance products, no person who acts for the bank as an insurance agent shall engage in any activities related to the making of loans or the granting of credits. Now, this is just one of several restrictions that were imposed by the 1987 legislature, and most of those provisions have proved to be very workable and have not been a problem. This is the exception. This one has not worked well. In fact, it has served as a very significant obstacle to banks getting involved in the marketing of insurance products. The reason for that is, and it doesn't really matter whether you're talking about a U.S. national or about a one-horse banking operation somewhere in Oregon, most banking in Oregon is done in small branch offices in smaller communities around the state. And in most cases, it's simply not economically feasible for the bank to have a separate person who runs the loan activity who's separate and apart from the person who would sell the insurance products. So the presence of this restriction in Oregon has been and continues to constitute, in the words of Graham-Leach-Bliley, a significant interference with the ability of a depository institution to engage in insurance activities, which was the purpose of the 1987 legislation. If you go back and look at the 13 safe harbor provisions in Graham-Leach-Bliley, you find that there is no provision there that allows this multitasking kind of rule that says that it's illegal or that a state can stop a loan officer from selling insurance. It's simply not one of the permitted provisions. And it is not substantially, this restriction is not substantially the same as or no more burdensome than the 13 safe harbors. There's actually nothing in those 13 safe harbor provisions that comes even close to this rule. Therefore, Graham-Leach-Bliley requires that this restriction on multitasking be deleted from the Oregon statute. Some will suggest that if you comply with Graham-Leach-Bliley by removing these anti-multitasking provisions, that loan officers might coerce borrowers into buying the insurance products as a price of getting a loan from the bank. But that coercion is clearly and unequivocally illegal, both under existing state law and as that state law would be amended by this bill, and also under several provisions of federal law. And I've specified what those provisions are in my testimony. I won't repeat those in detail. But it is already illegal and will continue to be illegal for a bank to try and tie in any way, not only insurance and loan products, but any products. There is an anti-tying statute that applies generally to all products, financial services, and products that banks offer. Simply can't do that. So we're asking that you make one further amendment, and I've actually drafted that up, and I think you now have copies of that amendment, that would simply delete from the existing Oregon statute this holdover restriction, which was perfectly legal when the 1987 legislature put it into place, but which now becomes illegal in the light of Graham-Leach-Bailey. We'd ask that that be removed from the statute, and we believe that with that change, we complete the job of bringing our law into compliance with the federal. Thank you very much for your attention. I'll be happy to respond to any questions.
Questions? Yes, Senator.
Thank you. Mr. Sherman, there's a couple of things regarding this, that provision that you're testifying to. A number of things, of course, have changed the last couple of years. The SEC is now, making rules on securities sales and securities analysts and separating those. Accountants and their consulting activities are now in the process of being separated, also for conflicts. And as I see this one, I'm curious from your testimony is that. You say this would be conforming to the Act. The Act, as you quoted, said may not engage directly or indirectly in insurance sales, sufficient cross-matching activity that significantly interferes with those abilities. And I'm just curious, number one, is why is it necessarily having another person who's an expert in insurance? I understand what you're talking about, limitations of banks, but that's kind of a business decision and how you employ people in different positions. But in terms of separating that, why is that necessarily a significant interference by saying we want an insurance expert separate from loan experts to engage in that practice? How does that reach that standard of significantly interfere?
Well, it's simply been our experience over the last 16 years, Senator Metzger, that in many, many cases, banks have told us that they have not gotten into insurance activities simply because they can't afford the duplication of manpower. They don't have enough business generated in any one business location to have a whole separate person devoted to insurance activities. And it's simply an economic impossibility. It's like in a small mom-and-pop grocery store requiring that there be a separate person who sells the eggs and another person who sells the tomatoes and another person who sells the roast beef. There's no reason for that multitasking. The concern that gave birth to that here in Oregon is adequately addressed by the anti-tying provisions, so there's no reason to retain it, and it's illegal to retain it under the congressional standard. That's why we want it to go away.
Yeah, just to follow up that, Mr. Sherman, but if in fact this was a good marketable product, which I assume is one of the reasons we're discussing this issue today, because banks would like to do more of this. That if it was a marketable product, wouldn't the marketing of the product itself imply that it is worthwhile having someone on staff to do that? I mean, if it was purely incidental to all the other banking activities, you probably wouldn't get into the market. I would assume that a bank would get into the market because they say this could be a profitable profit center for us, and therefore would be worthy of additional attention by staff.
Well, I think that's true, but like any other business decision, you've got to have a certain critical mass of activity, a certain volume of business to justify hiring another person, and that's basically what we're talking about. I think another point that needs to be understood is that we're the only ones left here who are subject to this kind of restriction. The insurance companies, and State Farm is a perfectly good example, they have their own bank. They don't have this restriction. The credit unions are engaged in insurance sales in this state. They don't have this restriction. There's no reason to specially discriminate against commercial banks and leave them out there as dinosaurs in terms of their ability to serve the marketplace. If they can serve the same customers with the same personnel, they're going to be able to offer their products more economically, and that's good for the consuming public.
Okay. Sure. So you say other financial institutions can do things other than group insurance that you are not able to do under that same
mm-hmm.
regulation?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I didn't know State Farm owns a bank.
Mm-hmm. They do.
That's where all our money goes.
It's not earning much interest right now, but I had no idea. Well, that was interesting. And so credit unions can do all of this, but you can't.
It's my understanding that they are not subject to this restriction, that they do not have to observe a rule that says that they can't have a loan officer selling insurance or an insurance person selling or making loans.
Mm-hmm. That's probably true, because I just went in with my brother to open up an account, and they offered him insurance on the account.
Mm-hmm.
So they were able to do that. That the credit
insurance life. On the account or insurance
it
on
was a loan. He got a loan, mm-hmm. and I think it's credit life insurance or mm-hmm. or some darn thing if you get sick or hurt or whatever. I don't know. I never buy that stuff, but they offer it that. And so you're
well,
talking
credit,
about
credit life is a little bit different.
Okay.
I'm talking about other insurance products, regular casualty insurance and life insurance
all
and that sort of thing.
Okay. Well, and while I have you, I just want to tell you, yours is one of the most cogent and well-organized pieces of testimony I've had in front of me this session, both orally and written.
Thank you very much.
So
thank you, Senator.
I just got to tell you that. As a court reporter, I appreciate that. Thank
you. My pleasure.
Questions?
I guess one obvious one comes to mind, Mr. Chair. If this amendment is not drafted, are you going to sue the insurance division?
Am I going to sue that? I'm a nice fellow, Senator Breyer. Actually, we have not discussed the possibility of litigation, but I think, you know, that possibility certainly exists, and it wouldn't necessarily be me. It might be any financial institution who felt that this was no longer in compliance with Graham-Leach-Bliley.
Mr. Chairman, if I can follow up on that, Mr. Chairman, Senator Breyer, the OBA did have kind of an ad hoc board meeting last week by teleconference and had a lot of Eastern Oregon and rural CEOs, and while the issue of litigation didn't come to the forefront, the CEOs on the call, not surprisingly, did think it was time to put this issue to rest. I mean, this was a huge battle in 1987. We would like to avoid that again in 2003, but it is an important issue. Some banks have gone out and bought insurance agencies, to get back to Senator Metzger's questions, in order to separate that. But it gets kind of tough, especially when you get in rural Oregon, the number of folks that work in individual branches. So we've made a decision on that, but it obviously is something that will have to be looked at.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. That just sparks a question for me. You talked about rural Oregon a couple of times. What would be the smallest bank you have in the state, which would probably be in rural Oregon, but how many employees do you think?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Walker, you know, this, I can get you the exact answer, but I'm guessing there are branches in rural Oregon that have, you know, complete staff less than 10, and that's obviously filling the whole, you know, work week. So,
Mr. Chairman, Senator Walker, if I can elaborate, I know of branches here in Salem that have less than 10. Right. I think there are branches out there that have 2 to 3 employees and significant numbers of them. And they're not necessarily way out in the hinterlands. A lot of them are just scattered around in various parts of the more populated state.
They can be little urban branches mm-hmm. in the
exactly.
neighborhood. Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Has there been any other litigation that defines whatever those two broad terms are?
Prevents or substantially interferes. Not that I've really researched. I mean, we have not looked at this from a standpoint of preparing for litigation in any way, shape, or form. But to me, just to take the plain meaning of those words and then to balance them against 16 years of Oregon experience, I have to tell you very frankly, when we passed this legislation in 1987, I expected there to be a lot more activity of banks getting into this. And as we've filtered through the last 16 years and asked the question why, over and over again, this one section, which is replicated 4 or 5 times in our statute, comes up as the answer. We simply cannot afford the personnel. It is a substantial impairment.
I suppose the language in the Federal Act is only a couple years old, isn't it? So there hasn't been a lot of...
That's correct.
Any other questions? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you very much.
Before you leave, we were talking about this amendment, this proposed amendment. It's basically deletions and inserting a portion. That's the first part of this, Section D, on page 5 of the bill. You should talk about that.
Yes. You'll notice I'm deleting all of this language that's in italics there. That is the restriction that I'm referring to, and it says no person who acts on behalf of the institution to sell insurance can be involved in the lending activity. And that same, the substance of that same language is repeated, as I say, I think four times in the statute, and that's why the length of the amendment just takes the same language out in four different places.
Just wanted to clarify that.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Now, we have the real Dave Nelson. And Richard Yost.
I know, he sent me a note into the chamber one day, and I thought it was you, and I went back to your desk thinking, why'd you send me a note?
You should put it in the real Dave Nelson. Welcome. Please introduce yourself. And
Mr. Chairman. Our Chair Nelson, members of the committee, it's a pleasure to have the opportunity to talk to you about Senate Bill 235. Also, just as an off the side, I understand that that you found yourself on the no-fly list at an airport recently.
Yeah,
so did I.
Did you?
So I must have been in. Yeah, we're both on the FBI no-fly list, and right. So we had to go through substantial screening to get on an airport.
Taking your shoes off right away.
So
the 22 is built.
Yeah, the reason is because there is a fellow from Tennessee by the name of Dave Nelson.
Is that the guy?
On the list, yeah.
All right.
He's 38 years old. And
how old?
38.
Ah, well, that's an honor then.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Dave Nelson. With me is Richard Yost, CLU, Legislative Chair of the Oregon Association of Insurance and Financial Advisors. That's formerly the Oregon Life Underwriters Association, renamed in compliance with Graham Leach Bliley, I suppose. The Oregon Association of Insurance and Financial Advisors is a membership trade association of life and health insurance agents and financial and planners and advisors. We have 15 local membership associations around the state, and we were very, very involved in the 1987 passage of House Bill 2451 and subsequently, I believe, Senate Bill 1024. We have a little bit different memory of that, but it was a brutal battle up and down the length of the halls of this Capitol that went on from the beginning of the session through the end of June before it was finally resolved, with the inclusion of those sideboards around the entry into the insurance business by the banks. Mr. Yost can give you a statement about that as part of our statement, and then we'll come back and talk a little bit more about that recollection.
Thank you, Dave. Mr. Chair, members of the Business and Labor Committee, my name is Richard Yost. I'm the Legislative Committee Chair of the Oregon Association of Insurance and Financial Advisors, and I reside in Eugene, Oregon. OREFA, as we refer to it, and other associations of insurance agents and others involved in financial activities worked with the insurance division of the DCBS during the interim in crafting SB 235, SB 252, and SB 253. These three bills, hopefully, complete implementation of the Congressional Graham-Leach-Bliley Act passed in late 1990s. Oregon's Insurance Division began the process of complying with the provisions of Graham-Leach-Bliley in the 2001 session of the legislature with passage of several pieces of legislation essentially dealing with the same or similar topics. SB 235 addresses authority of banks to act as insurance agents and sell insurance. Oregon addressed the issue of banks selling insurance in 1987 with passage of HB 2451 and SB 1024. These two bills were very contentious and hard fought by both banks and insurance agents. In the end, banks were permitted to sell insurance with a number of consumer protections. The single greatest pressure on a loan applicant is the direct or implied suggestion that their application for the loan may be received more favorably if the applicant also purchased the bank's insurance. To prevent undue pressure from arising in the course of a loan application, a number of protections were built into the law. They include separate locations for the bank business and the insurance business, prohibition on loan officers being licensed as insurance agents and selling insurance, written notice that the customer did not have to buy insurance from the bank as a condition of getting a loan,
restriction on use of information gathered by banks from clients and from insurance agent clients. Since passage of HB 2451 and SB 1024 in 1987, insurance agents and banks have gotten along well. Many bank insurance agents are members of ERAFA, and I believe many are members of other agent associations as well. In the negotiations and discussion of SB 235 during the interim, ERAFA agreed to remove the restriction on banks that required a separate location for their insurance activities. We agreed because we understand that separate locations may be an economic hardship in some rural banks. We don't believe consumers will be unduly pressured to buy from the bank if bank's insurance activity is at a separate desk staffed by a separate insurance agent. We also believe that maintaining separation of the loan function and insurance function is critical protection for consumers. It is also critical to insurance agents by maintaining fair competition between banks and agents. On behalf of the Oregon Association of Insurance and Financial Advisors, we urge your passage of SB 235 as negotiated during the interim and written in SB 235.
Mr. Chairman, a couple of comments on the previous testimony. As Mr. Martinez says, it was a huge issue. This particular issue in itself was a very hard-fought issue. And the issue really becomes also one of current budgetary restrictions on DCBS and on the insurance division in order to enforce the actions of banks selling insurance and the non-tied end provision sales. If you can imagine, the insurance division just does not have the personnel to monitor and oversee what's going on in the practice of insurance sales as far as banks are concerned, and has to rely solely on consumer complaints, either in insurance sales or in the banking business. So I think that it's an issue that once you allow a loan officer to become an insurance agent, then you have very little oversight, even though it may be statutorily illegal to have a tie-in sale. Just no way to enforce that. I think Mr. Sherman said and Mr. Martinez said that they know of many branches of banks that have 10 or fewer employees. I would also urge you to ask the question, are all 10 of those employees loan officers? I think the answer is obviously not. There are probably two or three or one loan officer in the bank, and the other personnel could easily become the licensed insurance agent. They just wouldn't be a loan officer at the same time. So they have a mechanism to get around or get by that provision and to have someone in their shop who is the licensed agent. A number of banks have also contracted with our members to be the insurance agent for the bank, and I can point to different arrangements around the state of Oregon where that accommodation has been made. We even have members who are officed inside the bank building and do the insurance function for the bank as well as their own business. So there are a variety of ways that banks have of implementing and complying with existing statute. We don't think and we disagree that that it is a violation of the safe harbor provisions to have this statutory restriction in the state of Oregon. I know Mr. Monroe, who is also an attorney, will speak to those the differences of opinion legally as far as Graham-Leach-Bliley and the implementation of that and as it applies to this particular restriction in the law. I'd also like to, I guess, conclude as to tell the committee that we agreed to the elimination of the separation of facilities. This issue never came up during the negotiations in the last 10 months to a year that we've been meeting with the insurance division. I find it a little bit opportunistic to come in here at the last minute and say, oh, by the way, we have an amendment to eliminate this major, major provision. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions?
I just want to clarify one thing, Mr. Nelson. The way I'm reading the testimony here is that you agreed to remove the restriction so banks can, they don't have to have a separate location for the insurance activities.
That's correct.
But you still think they should have a separate person.
A separate body, yes.
Other than a loan officer.
That's correct.
What classifies as a loan officer?
What
would classify as a loan officer? What are they engaged in besides making loans?
I think it probably, as far as me being a banker, I'm not a very good banker, as my banker will attest, but I think it would be better to ask the banking division, but there are a specific title within a bank of a person who is trained to do a loan officer function, and it's not a function that's extended to all employees of the bank.
Okay. Okay. So there's some training and certification probably.
Yes. There's training and all other approvals.
Just as there's training and certification for you to be insurance.
For insurance agents, correct.
Okay, very good. Any further questions? Which we've defined issues. Thank you very much. Thank you. Jack Monroe and Lana Butterfield.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Jack Monroe, here today on behalf of the Independent Insurance Agents and Brokers of Oregon. I personally wasn't surprised that there was a David Nelson on the no-fly list.
Is that the real David Nelson or the phantom?
I'll say no more about that topic, however, in terms of identifying which one I think it might have been. I'm obviously not going to try and go over ground that's already been plowed, but I'd like to make several points. One, I think, is, as has been indicated, both the existing statutory language and the new statutory language or proposed statutory language is replete with anti-tying related comments. That policy decision has been made and in the past, and I presume would be one that the Oregon legislature would like to continue to have in effect and simply, you know, one product is not dependent upon another. You understand the concept. I think that the language that we're arguing about here, though, if you think about it in a common sense way, if you are sitting across the table from the employee of the financial institution and the loan papers are on one side of the desk and the insurance papers are on the other, and there's a revolving nameplate in front of you, the inference that you might draw relative to whether or not you'll get the loan is that the insurance product, the related insurance product, is part of the equation. And so I think from our perspective, this is a bright line and an appropriate bright line. Now, let me refer to a couple of other things that have been discussed in the testimony that preceded mine. Ken Sherman is both a personal friend of mine and a fine attorney, and I think he was probably just using some shorthand, but Graham Leach Bliley doesn't require that the provision that we're talking about now or any other provision be deleted from the Oregon statutes. What Graham Leach Bliley did, as the insurance division suggested at the beginning, was to set up 13 safe harbors within which states could comfortably enact legislation relative to the consumer protection of bank insurance activities. Now, if there is existing legislation that may or may not be outside those 13 safe harbors, or for which there's a question, then those are not automatically preempted. They are, however, subject to the prevent or essentially or significantly interfere standard that was referred to earlier. So, again, Graham Leach Bliley does not speak to the fact that any of the any provision, including this one, that provision is automatically preempted. The multitasking argument is kind of an interesting one. I had some trouble with the grocery analogy, unless you're sort of required to buy fish if you really want roast beef. But it's frankly not the same, and so that analogy doesn't was a little bit lost on me. State Farm, I think, is a federally chartered bank and would be subject to these requirements, as would any other financial institution. And I guess the last point I might make, and it's bootstrapping on a comment that Dave Nelson just made. It's been 16 years since the initial statutes were enacted. In those 16 years, and since initially enacted in 87, we have made some adjustments to to the code as it relates to these consumer protection provisions, most specifically to the physical separation-related language. In those 16 years, this issue of loan officers being insurance agents never came up. And so I guess I'm suggesting to you, if it were really a significant restriction, you would have heard from members of the Oregon Bankers Association in previous sessions, and you haven't. I guess I would leave you with one other thought, too. The reason that a lot of banks haven't gotten into insurance-related activity is because they're different businesses, and frankly, most banks haven't done very well in the insurance business, those that have tried to get into the business. And that is probably, I won't say it's more the reason, but it is a significant reason why many financial institutions aren't in the business. So I think with those comments, I'd be obviously happy to attempt to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Monroe, you said that in 16 years since the initial statute was enacted, this issue has never come up. Why is it coming up this year?
Senator Nelson, Senator Walker, I guess I can't tell you for sure why it's coming up. I mean, I presume that it's a question of opportunity, but probably that would be a question more appropriately directed toward the proponents of the amendment. But I think it's probably we are getting into this whole area, and as was suggested, there's been a lot of discussion in the last year, and there's probably an opportunity. And that's pure speculation on my part. But
I just wondered if there have been any occasions where any action had been taken against a bank or violating the act, or the bank felt that they just didn't have the opportunity to fulfill all of the goals that they have in mind.
Again, Senator Nelson, Senator Walker, I don't have any personal knowledge of that having occurred. That would the regulator, I would guess, would be the party who could more appropriately answer that question.
I'll ask the proponent. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Pam Levitt on the list to testify.
Is that
Pam Levitt on the list to testify? Jack, a question. When you were in my office, I asked the same question that somebody asked earlier, is whether or not credit unions or this provision applies to credit unions. You said you would get back the answer. Mr. Sherman indicated that it did not. Would you agree with that?
Senator Nelson, Senator Beyer, I think Mr. Sherman said he did not believe that to be the case, and I think that would be my response. I took a quick look through the Oregon financial statutes. They did give me some encouragement, because I thought that the most obtuse sections of the code were in fact the insurance code, but that might not be the case, and there are multiple sections, and frankly I did not find it, so I have to assume that might be accurate. I simply don't know.
Yeah, at some point in time.
Yeah, at some point I'll worry. Yeah. We can't make assumptions.
Yeah, another question?
No.
Okay, good. Senator Messenger?
Not the moment.
Okay. Thank you very much. Again, just for the committee, Jack is representing independent insurance, and Larry is representing professional insurance. Is that correct? So it's not up here together as a type. I just called them up. They were not signed up together. So, Lana, go, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Lana Butterfield, and I'm here representing the Professional Insurance Agents of Oregon, Idaho. And this issue is one that I cut my teeth on in 1987. Frank Bronner, who many of you may know, was the proponent at that time. And when Frank would get up, I would get up, and I'd kind of follow him around. And, in fact, the two of us got to go before the Salem Statesman Journal in an editorial board. This was called one of the hottest little business issues, one of the 10 business issues of that session. The professional insurance agent simply wants to be on record in agreeing with Mr. Monroe and the lobbyist, Mr. Nelson, in their comments. Thank you.
Questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ken, why don't you come back up and
give the answer?
She keeps moving around the room.
Yeah. Question for Mr. Ario now, too, at some point.
Yeah, Mr. Ario. Yeah, we might. Mr. Ario, you want to come up, too, or if somebody else wants to talk to you?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my honor to be here for the first time this session. And I can't provide you with many answers, but I can tell you in reviewing Senate Bill 235 with our attorneys, we specifically looked at Section 6. And if you note, on page 4, line 27, it says Section 6, ORS 708A, amended to read. And that does not apply to credit unions. However, the beginning of the bill, defining a depository institution, we are included under that definition. So we've been quite confused about understanding Senate Bill 235 and its implications on credit unions. Now, to answer your specific questions, I would like to get some additional information from our attorneys. It is our understanding that credit unions are not licensed insurance agents. We do sell the credit life, the gap insurance, the very specific insurance products related to a loan or an account. We're not selling the life insurance products at the credit union. That would be done through our for-profit entities called CUSOs, Credit Union Service Organizations. And so it's my understanding from what Ken said, we are not sitting there. We don't have that ability to have the one person selling all these insurance products. It's just the insurance products on the loans. But I will get some additional information for you if that is okay. I'm not an insurance expert at all, and it's a very technical issue, but I would be happy to answer all your questions.
Okay. Ken, since you've been sort of the focus of this, why do you want to?
Well, I certainly appreciate the additional information, and I'm certainly no expert in credit unions, so there's a lot of ignorance up here right now, but we'll certainly get that point clarified. It's been my understanding that credit unions have not been subject to this restriction, but we need to get that clarified. And there's one other thing that I would like to clarify. A couple of the previous speakers talked about this physical separation issue and congratulated themselves that that restriction is going away, and wasn't that nice that they gave it up. But if you'll look at page 3 of the bill, at lines 3 through 5, that says that these entities, and these are one of the safe harbor provisions, cannot solicit or sell insurance unless the insurance sales activities of the depository institution or affiliate are, to the extent practicable, physically separated from areas where retail deposits are routinely accepted by depository institution. So we've still got physical separation. That has not gone away. And we're not saying that it should go away, because it's one of the safe harbors that Graham Leach Bliley said was okay for a state to impose. The reason we're here today is because we think this other restriction regarding the insurance sales by loan officers is not in that list of 13 safe harbors.
Is that the question that Mr. Monroe brought up?
Yeah, well, I think Mr. Nelson made the first comment about how they'd given up the physical separation as a part of this process. And there is a change in the language. There's an existing Oregon statute that deals with physical separation that reads a little differently than this new language, but the concept of physical separation is still there, and we're not arguing with that.
Yeah. I remember that Mr. Monroe said something that maybe you had misinterpreted the federal act. Is that in response to that, or is that something different?
No, that's not. That's in response to the comment made about the physical separation. I simply disagree with Mr. Monroe on the interpretation. I certainly agree that just because something isn't in the safe harbors, one of those 13 rules, doesn't mean that it's preempted. And in fact, in my testimony, I never used the term preemption. What I did say is that if it's not in the safe harbors, and if it can be shown to either prevent or substantially interfere with the sale of insurance by banks, then Congress doesn't permit that restriction to continue. And we think this rule on loan officers and insurance sales fits that category fairly clearly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On that issue, Mr. Sherman, I see there's quite a different language from what current law has been. to what this proposed law amendment is, because this is talking about two areas where retail deposits are routinely accepted. Mm-hmm. And under the current law, as it reads today, if this bill was not to pass, it's talking about the premises in which the institution carries on the banking businesses. And I don't think the issue is that where deposits are accepted, that would be the teller. The issue, from my understanding, the previous testimony was the loan officer is the person who cannot be an insurance agency. And this new wording doesn't speak to loan officers. This is where deposits are accepted.
Well, Senator Beyer, we're confusing two areas. The business of banking is specifically defined in the Bank Act as the taking of deposits. If you go to Chapter 706.005, it defines business of banking as the taking of deposits. So if it says in the old rule you can't do these things in the place where the business of banking is taking place, and then you say in the new rule you can't do it where you're taking deposits, they're saying exactly the same thing. But this business of the loan officer is really a separate issue. It's not dealt with in the statute that you were just quoting from. It's dealt with in another statute that it would not be changed by mm-hmm. this bill except for our amendment.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, if those two terms are meant to mean the same thing, because they don't mean the same thing when I read them. I'm not an attorney. But so I guess that would be up to interpretation of our insurance code or division or something like that, or because they don't mean the same thing when I read them personally.
Well, and I would certainly agree that if you just ask somebody, what is the business of banking, the answer would be much longer than just taking deposits. But in fact, that is how the Bank Act in Oregon defines that term. I mean, that's what that term means, is the taking of deposits.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is for Mr. Ario. I'm just curious. You indicated in your testimony that there had been work on this for quite some time during the interim, and there has been, on this particular issue, some dispute, Mr. Sherman, Ms. Monroe, and others, in terms of the legal responsibility of the federal act under that. And I was wondering, in the course of your working on these issues during the interim, did you ask either from your position with the insurance division or through the finance securities division any opinion from the attorney general as to whether there was a requirement that this be changed at all?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Metzger, we did not ask the Attorney General that, but we did look at the litigation that's being brought on this issue. It's a question of federal law, not state law. And so far in the litigation, and the two states that are most furthest along in that litigation process are West Virginia and Massachusetts, this particular issue is not part of that litigation. So it, to my knowledge, is still not an object of focus at the federal level. And when I've asked around about it, and not surprisingly, if you're talking to somebody who comes out of the banking industry, they think it clearly will be struck. And if you talk to somebody on the insurance side, they think it clearly will be okay. So you're not going to get, I think, an objective view. And the OCC, which is the federal agency that's most likely to have an expert opinion on this, stays rigorously cautious about these issues until they're forced to render opinions, because at some point, probably in some state, this provision or something fairly closely analogous to it will be challenged by somebody, and so they're trying, it's hard to get an opinion until that actually is joined as an issue. I can offer a couple comments on the credit union issue if you'd like. Before I say them, I should associate myself with Ken's comment about ignorance at the table, because we don't have all the answers on this yet either, but I can clarify a couple things. One, the intent of the bill and the way it's written, I think Pam correctly states, which is that if credit unions are involved in the sale of insurance, the provisions of this bill will now apply to them. So that is the intent, and I think that intent is accomplished in the bill. Secondly, there's a question about whether credit unions can be currently involved in the sale of insurance. They were not included in the 1987 law. There's a bit of a dispute between the banks and the credit unions over that issue. And as far as we know today, they're still not allowed in the business of insurance. Now, I've heard various allegations by various people, including today's, that credit unions are involved in the sale of insurance. We don't get any complaints on it, and I haven't seen it happening. I can't promise you it's not, but to our knowledge still, they're not involved except on these very limited ways with credit products. I know we don't get consumer complaints in that area. So basically what we do in this bill is to say if the credit unions ever do succeed in being allowed to get into the insurance business, they will be subject to the same restrictions as everybody else. But we're, again, we're trying to stay out of as many fights as we can here, and one of them about whether credit unions can be in or can't be, we're not addressing. And just one last point, because this is the part that confuses people, I think. That does not mean that a credit union can't have a business relationship with an insurance company, and they might even be on the same premises involved in a mutual effort. What it means is that the credit union as a corporate entity is not the entity doing it. Any insurance business would be through some kind of cooperative agreement with a duly authorized insurance entity. Now, I don't know if that shed light or confused, but that's the best I can do.
I appreciate that, and I agree with Senator Beyer. It would be very interesting if we can find out the specifics of that. I mean, my own personal background in working with a very large credit union, that was certainly not a practice, did not sell insurance. But there was for-profit entities, what Pam mentioned was CUSOs, that sold a number of things. They were for-profit groups that were affiliated with or not credit union itself. But I think it would be very interesting to see if the law is permissive or not currently, and if this legislation were enacted, what, if any, changes that would do so that there was some equality between that. But I agree, I haven't seen any practice of that, so I thought that was rather interesting too, Senator Barr.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Metzger, I can tell you that along the way, the credit unions came to us and asked if this bill could be used as a vehicle to allow them into the insurance industry, and our response was the same as it's been to any other, what we regard as tangential amendments, which is if everybody agrees, we don't have a problem with that, but if anybody disagrees, we do, and people haven't agreed on that point yet. So.
Legislature.
Yeah.
Sounds like the Godfather and the dead horse.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you. One more question. Actually, Senator Walker's question as to if this issue is not brought up in the 10 months of negotiations on this bill, why is it being brought forward now as an amendment?
Well, I guess I'll have to respond to that, Senator Beyer. We weren't involved in 10 months of negotiation on this bill. This is the first time we've ever sat down in the same room with our fellows from the insurance industry. This bill came to us, and we reviewed it, and we looked at it in comparison to the Graham-Leach-Wiley provisions, and we said, well, it's 90% there, but there's this one element of it that we thought was not covered, and so we brought that back to Mr. Ariel. We sat down, we had a couple of meetings, we talked about it, and he said, well, I would prefer that we just take that issue to the legislature because the insurance people are going to not like that. And I don't blame them. I mean, why would you want to open up your field of business to more competition? And that's understandable, but that's what brought us here. I mean, we just haven't had the opportunity to deal with this. And the question also came up, why has this risen for the first time in 16 years? Well, for 16 years, there's been nothing on the federal scene that said this kind of provision was questionable or illegal. But I'm saying now that with the passage of Graham-Leach-Bliley, it is questionable and I think illegal for us to continue this provision in place. And that's why we seek now to challenge it.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Beyer, if I can add a couple words on that. I think it is fair what Ken said, that the 10 months refers to how long we've been trying to get people's attention on the issue. As you well know here, it sometimes takes until close to the legislative session to get everyone's concentrated attention, so it has been a much shorter span in which the real concentrated discussions have gone on. But the ideas out here have been out there and being discussed by some number of people for a longer period of time. The other comment I want to make, and I think this is very important data to not lose sight of. What we've tried to do is take the issues that we think are clear-cut and that we can accomplish in a piece of legislation like this, and that is essentially the safe harbor pieces. There could be any number of additional challenges about other aspects of Oregon law that potentially could be challenged under Graham-Leach-Bliley, and this agreeing to have this amendment be discussion as part of our bill was always intended only as an opportunity to have that issue considered, but we would clearly ask the committee that if they can't come to agreement on that issue, that that issue is essentially conceptually separate from our bill, and insofar as there's agreement on the 13 safe harbors, that part of the bill could move forward, and at any time and in any forum, somebody can raise issues about other aspects of law that pertain to sort of relevant topics and have separate fights. But we would hope, and I hope we still have the agreement of all the parties on this, which are that either way that this fight comes out, the parties agree that the rest of the bill go forward and not be torpedoed by the inability to agree on this particular point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And on that issue, I guess, I know last session as a chair of the business committee, we did conforming language to Graham Leach. And I'm not going to pretend that I've ever even looked at the federal code. It's probably that thick. Is this being brought forward now as opposed to last session because you hadn't gotten this part of it yet? Or why is it we didn't do it all last session?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Beyer, very good question. The 13 safe harbors are pretty clearly laid out in federal law, but when we were in our session in 2001, there still was a pretty large set of disputes about exactly how to translate the words of the federal law into state law as a model state law. That process was going on both through my national association, National Association of Insurance Commissioners, and some of the banking regulator associations. And so the final language of how to turn that federal code into model state language wasn't completed, and so it wasn't ready for us, and so we decided it was better than to take our own shot at that. We would simply wait until those models were developed, and it actually worked out well in the sense that the model that was worked out through my national association hasn't been owned by the banking regulators. They have their own counsel on these matters, but it has been cited favorably in some of their decisions about other issues like the one we're talking about here with the loan officers. They've cited approvingly that this provision is okay because it's within the NAIC model, and this one maybe not within the NAIC model. So we think the model language that we're bringing you for the safe harbors is now a consensus sort of product of all the regulators and better than it would have been in 2001.
Senator Metzger.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know, Katie, you want to respond to this or not. It's more of a comment, maybe, but in just thinking about this particular subset of the greater bill you're talking about, your comments regarding these firewalls, because the status quo, the firewall exists, you know, based on the 87 legislation. And I just find this interesting because you're commenting on making some changes, deleting these out of basically the insurance company's bill. And the thing that's I'm going through in my mind is if this was a significant issue for the banking industry, then I would have fully expected to have a proactive bill before this legislative session brought forth by the bankers to make changes in that particular provision. But there is no legislation to do that. You're commenting on a piece of work done by the insurance to actually modify that. But I would think if this was really an important issue for the banking industry, why in either 01 or 03 we haven't had a piece of legislation proposed by the banking industry to make that change. I mean, to me, that tells me this has not been a significant issue.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Metzger, it certainly is a significant issue. The reason we waited for this context was because we knew this bill would be coming forward. We knew that it was going to deal with this subject. And we've always been careful not to flood this House with superfluous legislation. We don't have very many bills introduced. Our practice has changed somewhat in the last 25 years that I've been involved in this process, and we try and do this as economically as possible. This is a perfectly good opportunity to address this important issue, but the fact that we do so by way of proposed amendments should not in any way suggest that we regard it as less important. I mean, we could certainly introduce a separate bill, but this was a good place to bring it to the attention of the legislature and deal with it.
Okay. Very good. Thank you.
Appreciate it.
There's some amendments out there and some issues here, and I hope that the parties continue talking to each other and we'll close the public hearing and not go into a work session on this bill. Close the public hearing. Open up public hearing on Senate Bill 237. And Mr. Dodson.
Senate Bill 237 increases bond amounts for certain nonprofit organizations who elect to be reimbursing employers. No fiscal impact and fiscal correction. No revenue impact. Fiscal impact statements been issued.
Okay. Welcome.
Good afternoon.
Please introduce yourself.
I'm Renee Bryant. I'm tax manager in the employment department.
I'm Rob Edwards. I'm the central operations supervisor for the tax section of the employment department.
Chair Nelson, members of the committee, this bill has been before you now three times. Last time, Senator Metzger asked that we provide some clarifying information relative to the number of smaller nonprofit organizations who fail to meet their obligations to reimburse the trust fund. We provided that information by letter. Hope you all got it. Are there any questions on that letter?
Anything?
No, it was very helpful.
Mm-hmm. Any further questions on this group? Senator Walker, we're fine?
I'm fine.
There's no other person signed up to testify, so we'll just close the public hearing and then go into a work session here if everybody's satisfied. Close the public hearing. Open up a work session on Senate Bill 237.
Chair, move Senate Bill 237 to the floor with the due pass.
Senator Metzger has moved Senate Bill 237 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. And any other comments?
Well, I have a big comment. Just thank you for the information because that was an important issue. And in looking at what was presented to us, that there were, as suspected, you know, a lot of the 100,000 under, you know, were the major number of participants, but the total dollars, the two that were above 100, were the significant amount. And I think that actually provides the justification for the bill. And I think that just was a good part of this process so that to answer those questions. And I appreciate you folks doing that.
Thank you very much. Good. So if there's no objections, motion to send it to the floor with a due pass recommendation is hereby approved. We'll close the work session on Carrier. Senator Metzger, do you want to carry that?
Sure. Happy to do that.
Where do you want to do
it? You want to do it?
No. No, I thought, didn't we just pass the amendment? There was no amendment.
There was no amendment.
I'm asleep at the wheel.
No.
It's because we don't have coffee anymore.
That's because we don't.
I never drank it.
Okay, we'll open up a public hearing on House Bill 2055. Mr. Dotson.
House Bill 2055, engrossed, authorizes addition of collection fee to debts owed to public body when the public body uses a private collection agency to collect the debt. Stipulates that the collection fee would be payable by the debtor and may not exceed the collection fee of the private collection agency. And there are amendments.
Matt, why don't you come on up and present your case.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Matt Marquis representing the Oregon Collectors Association. I'd first just like to give you a brief history of how we got to House Bill 2055. In 1997, during the interim after that legislative session, our association worked in conjunction with the Senate Budget Committee to try and inventory all the state receivables owed to the state of Oregon. During that process, which was fairly lengthy, took several months, we found about $1.8 billion in monies owed to the state of Oregon. Now, that's not all general funds. Some of that's other funds. Some of that is child support and whatnot. One thing we did find was at that time that a lot of state agencies had a hard time producing the required information because a lot of them didn't keep track of their receivables at that time. So in 1999, the legislature passed a bill, House Bill 3509, which most importantly required state agencies to do reporting to legislative fiscal office annually on the state of their receivables so that we could start keeping track of how much was owed to the state of Oregon. The bill further required state agencies that if no payment had been received on one of these receivables in a year, that account would be turned over to a private collection agency. What we've found is that many state agencies feel like they're losing money by turning accounts over to the private collection agency, even though most of those accounts wouldn't otherwise be collected. So there's a loss of incentive there to turn accounts over to the private sector as quickly as they should be. House Bill 2055 allows government entities to add a collection fee to the receivable when it is turned over to a private collection agency. This becomes a powerful tool. It's not a mandatory fee, it's permissive, but it becomes a powerful tool for the state agency to use in trying to collect their debts. The state of Washington currently uses this fee, as does our judicial department here in Oregon. The bill also allows a similar fee on commercial accounts when one business is trying to collect from another business. This fee in no time would ever exceed the amount that a private collection agency charges. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Yeah, on that issue there, somebody brought up a due process question of whether if you could actually add that on without giving them notice at some time, and we have asked our legislative council to check on that, so that is out there.
Mr. Chair, the only response I have is I know that the state of Washington's language that they use is very similar to this, and the judicial department is currently doing this here in Oregon, so I don't know that that's a problem. We did request an amendment on the commercial accounts to make sure that it was an agreement between the two parties prior to the collection fee being added. And I believe the amendment on that will take place on page 1, line 16. It would just be added to the end of that something, added to the end of that sentence something similar to, and is not in agreement by the two parties, so that that collection fee couldn't be added unless it was in agreement.
Okay, where is that at now?
Page 1, section 2, line 16.
Okay. Okay. Good questions.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
Matt, and I don't know if you know the answer right now, but $1.8 billion in 97, can you have the answer to what that number is? As of the latest forecast or report, it was issued in December, and I don't have it in front of me either. But
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I do have the numbers that were issued in December. And they're going to be, I think I do, it's about $1.1 billion is what was reported. And that's not because it has reduced. It's because the things that are being reported to legislative fiscal office, it's a different criteria of information that we did on our original inventory. For instance, much of the child support money isn't reported to legislative fiscal. Some of the Oregon University System's money isn't reported. Those are the only two that I can think of offhand, but there isn't. It's not exactly the same amount of information that's being reported.
Thank you.
Okay. I'd heard a figure at some point of $350 million or something like that.
Mr. Chair, I can answer that question, so you've probably heard that number from me. There is, in the latest report, in the Department of Revenue, somewhere between $320 and $350 million of general fund dollars.
So it's general fund dollars.
And that is just general fund dollars. And so hopefully there will be someone here from the Department of Revenue that can answer some questions I have on that issue.
Mr. Chair, I can add, too, that from 2001 to 2002, of the stuff that was reported to legislative fiscal, that grew by about $60 million in that year, but that doesn't take into account adjustments and write-offs. So that it's a deceiving number. The $60 million could be more because of write-offs and such.
Do you have any figures on success or percentage of how many of these collections
Mr. Chair, the percentage rate of the private collection agencies that they've collected has been fairly low. It's a lot lower than the national average right now, and mostly that's due to two reasons. The accounts that we get now are fairly old. Most of them are well over a year old. And the other part is that we're not allowed to sue or issue garnishments on these accounts. And we're working on that process now with the Attorney General. But a great majority of the collections done in the private sector from one private sector to another are done through litigation. And that's not right now. It's the only person that can sue on the behalf of the state of Oregon is our Attorney General, but we're looking at some options through small claims where maybe our private collection agencies can be allowed to issue certain go through certain litigation processes there.
I hear a figure 8% or something like that.
It varies from agency to agency. There are some agencies that are at 8% on their collection rate. There are some that are lower and there are some that are higher. I think our average is probably under 8% though.
Further questions at this point? Okay.
The quicker that these things get turned over, the collection rate will go a lot higher. So, and by adding this fee, we'd hope that would help speed the process up when the state agency gets reimbursed their whole amount.
Okay.
Gives them incentive.
We'll check on this due process question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Matt. I appreciate it. Please,
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Lisa Zavala from the Oregon University System. We had asked the committee to introduce and to entertain some amendments to this bill. When our business offices and collections people at our campuses saw the language that's in Section 1, that states that a public body may not add a fee under the section that exceeds the collection fee of the private collection agency, some questions arose as to how that would put us in position with our federal loans. Some federal laws, in particular the federal Perkins loans and the federal family education loans programs, allow and in some cases require the campuses to assess the borrower either interest or late fees on these loans, student loans. So we would like to ask for some amended language that would just allow the provision of the language would read, unless given authority to assess additional fees by state, local, or federal statute or regulation. That would just clarify it for our business officers that, in fact, they do have the authority and the responsibility to assess additional fees.
Okay. And you do give notice, you say, in there.
Oh, yes. In fact, promissory notes that the student signs when they sign for a loan indicates that they will be assessed these additional fees.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, all of you run these amendments by the proponents of the legislation?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, yes, we have, and we don't anticipate any problems with that.
Okay. Thank you.
Further questions?
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it. Do we have some representatives from Department of Revenue and Department of Controls and DAS, John DeFreen and Susan Browning? Please come up and thank you for coming home. Appreciate it. Please introduce yourself.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Susan Browning with the Oregon Department of Revenue.
And I'm John DeFrain with the State Controller's Office, Department of Administrative Services.
Who wants to start here first?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I do have a summary of what's in the accounts receivable for the Department of Revenue, if that would be helpful.
Yes.
I believe Senator Beyer had a question about that, I understood from Dennis. So.
I'm going to get this Hannah Barron here in good shape.
And I'll wait for those to reach you, but I did want to point out when you look at this summary, I put it together this morning for your purposes, and it's as of December 2002. So the LFO report that you're referring to was as of June 30th, 2002. So these are a little bit more updated figures, but so they don't translate quite across, but I thought you would prefer more up-to-date figures.
Okay. These are general fund. That's what we're talking about.
This is for the, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This is the personal income tax program.
Okay.
And we do have other accounts receivable, but this is by far the largest for the Department of Revenue. We do have other funds as well, but this is general fund personal income tax program. With your permission, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll just point out a few things about
sure.
this report.
Please do that.
Okay, you see the beginning balance. This is as of December 2002 again, so these are actual numbers for 2002. And we use this for internal purposes as well. You notice the additions is $78,200,000. That, I want to point out, that is money that taxpayers have admitted they owed. When they send in their tax returns, they are unable to pay in full. So they send in partial payment or no payment. But a part of this as well, and a growing part of it, is the amount of money that we assess or estimate the people who are not filing and not paying owe the state. We have had a quite active filing enforcement program that you as the legislators have staffed and funded for the department. And our main project is to go out and do data matching, follow-up leads, look at lots of data sources to identify Oregonians or non-residents who should be filing and paying Oregon personal income tax. We then go out and attempt to identify how much income we think those individuals made and then estimate how much tax they would owe as well. So we set those up, we call setups, and then we put those in as part of the accounts receivable, and then we pursue collection.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question that just came to me. I'm a court reporter, and I've had occasion for many years to work in federal grand jury where we find these people who are manufacturing drugs and making money illegally. And I know that we have charged them with the crime of evasion of taxes. How do you get notice from our criminal law enforcement that someone is making money by doing an illegal activity so that you can do an assessment and go after them for tax?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, we have several sources of information. A lot of it comes from the federal government. We do get information from the court system, from taxpayers who call anonymously and refer people that they know should be paying taxes who are not. So we put all the information together and go out and sort that and match it against. We try to confirm it as much as we possibly can. The best information available is what our standard is. And then we match that and try to determine how much income they are making, whether it's legal or illegal. And then based on that and what we think would be a reasonable family size and those kind of criteria, what does that translate into as far as taxes owed? So this is somewhat different than the other state agencies' accounts receivable because it does include that component, and that's a growing component because the legislature has seen that that's an important piece to get non-filing taxpayers is kind of a contradiction in terms, but those people who should be filing and paying into the system. So part of this includes that amount of money that we estimate. The taxpayers can always come forward with their real return and many times, not until this becomes final and part of our accounts receivable, when we go out and actually start garnishing their paychecks or their accounts, do they realize it's important to come forward and share with us information on what their true income was and their true tax. So this will be adjusted down accordingly once they come forward with true information, if we agree with it. Otherwise, the assessment will stand and we'll pursue collection of that full amount. You can see that actual, what's on the accounts receivable, the sum total. One of the pieces of the 1999 legislation was the ability to petition the Department of Administrative Services for an exemption for certain kinds of accounts or different things that don't quite match any of these exemptions that are granted by statute or by rule. And the Department of Revenue asked for exemption of the filing enforcement. That is the non-filer work, where we really are going after people for filing, not filing, and not paying. And you can see as of December 2002, this bottom line down here, DAS petition approved filing enforcement is $125,257,000.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Walker.
Could you please state that again? Is that the amount that is for the non-filing taxpayers? Is that what you just said, $125 million?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, yes, that $125,257,000, that line down there, DAS petition approved filing enforcement, that is for those individuals with whom we're working in the personal income tax program only who have not filed and not paid. So we're working to gain compliance with them. A big piece of what we want them to do is to file. Obviously, we want them to pay in full, but some of these people, they've just gotten into bad habits. They lost their job. They had medical bills. They stopped filing. But we want them to get back in the system, become filers again, and pay their debt so that the pie is bigger for all of Oregon to draw from.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Originally, you said part of your additions in the second line is that non-filing taxpayers.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, yes, that's correct.
How much of that line up there is also non-filing taxpayers?
78 million.
78 million is as of December 2002, what we've added to this since the last report. These are internal reports that we run that are interim between this report and the next one. So this we added over the course of 6 months was the 78 million. I think, as I recall, Senator Beyer, we added additional staff. Right. We added additional staff to work on filing enforcement from July 2002 till December 2002. I believe they added, and I'll double check my figures on this, I believe we added 2,000 taxpayers into the program and $20 million in for non-filing taxpayers as an estimate.
Mr. Chair, that gets to my point. So of this $78 million, $20 million of that is for non-filing taxpayers, or the entire $78 million is for non-filing taxpayers?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, $20 million of the $78 million.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, so yes, we in July did add money for you to hire people to go out and get collect more taxes. So what this shows me is that you've added more to your delinquent accounts. How much have you actually collected in taxes with that additional dollars? Because putting a number of $20 million on your balance sheet as uncollectible is not the same as collecting taxes. Obviously, we're well aware of that.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, the next line down, the collections, mm-hmm. on the very beginning, the third line down,
mm-hmm.
you're talking about $78 million we added. The $32,800,000 is the collections as of the end of December on that same amount of the accounts receivable.
Okay, so you're saying that how much would that have been had we not added the extra people in June?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, the filing enforcement, we have set goals for the additional people that you added to the Department of Revenue of a net of a gross of $27.9 million for the filing enforcement additional people. And we are on track to collect it. So we were, as of before we had the budget reductions for the Department of Revenue, we were on track to come in with our commitment back to you because we committed to $27.9 million from those additional staff. We've been tracking it monthly. We're right on course to meet that. In addition, the Department of Revenue said that we thought we could really speed up collections on the simpler to collect accounts and bring in an additional $16 million without additional staff. We were also on track to collect that. So we've been doing quite well on our collections with the new staff that you gave us. We had some really motivated and highly trained people. So we were doing well with our collections. I did, if I may point out, maybe this would help Senator Beyer a little bit about where the accounts receivable is, the rest of it.
Okay.
If you'd like me to proceed forward with that. Write-offs, that's the amount of money that we write off because individuals, taxpayers die or various things such as that. We're not able to pursue that. Adjustments, that's the piece where, as I mentioned, we estimate how much someone owes as part of their taxes. When they actually come forward, we will revise it down, and that's the revision down piece right there, once we get more information. So then you net that all out, and on the far right-hand corner, far right-hand top piece, you see $341 million roughly as of December 2002. Now, walking down to Section 2, that's the accounts assigned to private collection agencies. And right now we have about, as the end of December, about $74,245,000 out of private collection agencies. And that's from subtracted from $341 million. The beginning balance was $75,000. We added about $8,000. They collected about $752,000 and returned about $8.9 million back to the department as uncollectible. Is everybody following along on all these numbers? This is kind of like accounting 101, I know, for most people. But accounts receivable is not the most easy thing to walk through for a lot of people. And then as you go down to Section 3, this is the piece I mentioned that House Bill 3509, when it was passed in 1999, there was a realization that there were some accounts that would be very, very difficult to collect, or that you probably, as legislators, would not want the state agencies to collect, or that are not legally collectible at this time. The first, and this Section 3, unavailable for collection, that's those different exemption pieces right in there. The big piece for the Department of Revenue is litigation, bankruptcy, mediation. Those are tax debts that are right now in bankruptcy, and they are legally not collectible, or the person is working through the tax court process or other legal means. So that's the legal piece of it up there, that $30.6 million you see at the very top. And I'll just touch upon the big ones. There's several different factors there. But the next big one is hospitalized debtor, $15 million if a debtor's in the hospital long term. We do have a few in there that have quite a high tax debt right now that are in the hospital. An imprisoned debtor, you can see that. Accounts less than $100, a little over $1 million on that. And then you work down through different categories. The sum total of exemptions, or on Section 3, unavailable for collections, by the standard categories is about a little over $48 million, if you see that piece there. And I already mentioned the DAS petition approved, which is the filing enforcement piece, the part that we're working with on that. And our staff has had pretty good success on that. Senator Beyer did bring up a good point. filing enforcement, working with people who have not filed and not paid is tough work. It does not have the same rate of return as it does working with people who are in the system and have admitted they owe $1,000. You know that they recognize that and they have that responsibility and want to comply. People who have spent oftentimes many years not filing and are working more of a underground economy, whether that's through drugs or whatever, we have to work hard to get them to recognize the responsibility of filing and paying. And oftentimes it involves a lot more aggressive collection action. So it takes us a while to collect that. Our rate of collection over time is 97%, though, for the Department of Revenue on the personal income tax program. It does take time. And then the bottom line, I put it in bold, and it's a little bit misleading. It says amount available for the Department of Revenue to collect. That's really the amount of self-assessed or admitted tax debt that's available for the Department of Revenue to collect. That's taking out the filing enforcement exemption piece, and it's taking out the amount that's out at private collection agencies, and it's also taking out the amount that we cannot touch because it's in bankruptcy or legal hold of some type. So that's a little over $93.5 million down there at the bottom. And that's where I mentioned we're working on the $16 million additional commitment. That's where we're working really hard on that, is to try to change our processes, really speed it up, go to warrant faster, and some of those kind of things, so we can really bring the debt in more quickly.
Sure. Thank you. Could you tell me the age that you are right now turning these things over to a private collection agency? Because I see under your center section that the collections by this private collection agencies is about 1% of what's been being turned over to them. And that seems extremely low. Can you tell me how these are aged? How long do you have them before the private collection agencies get them?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, we're under the provisions of the 1999 statutory change too. The Department of Revenue has 1 year to collect, to get a payment before it's turned over to a private collection agency. We did have a backlog, and we've worked through the backlog of accounts. For many years, we've been using private collection agencies to collect out-of-state debt. Oh, thank you, Mr. Hart. For many years, we've been using out-of-state collections agencies because we do not go outside the state of Oregon to do collections. But with House Bill 3509 and the 1999 legislation, we came under the auspices of that. So we looked at all the accounts that had been 1 year without a payment, and we turned all those over to private collection agencies. And so those have pretty much worked their way through. And Mr. Dufresne has some numbers that can show the kind of flow of accounts to the private collection agencies. So the Department of Revenue's accounts that are coming out to private collection agencies now are much more timely and should be within that one-year frame on the whole. Because we did have a backlog that had been sitting there, and we've sent that all out. So it should be pretty much flushed through the system now.
Well, Mr. Chair, I mean, your accounts have grown in 6 months by $20 million. And, you know, if you start on the top from 321 to 341, and at the same time, we've been offering additional employees to you, or you've been requesting them, and we've been granting some. And again, right now, in the budget bill that just passed the Senate today, there's an additional, I don't remember, $3 million or something like that for, and you said you would collect 16. So I'm trying to figure out why, if we're doing such a good job collecting, why does this number keep growing? And if we're getting out within a timely fashion of 1 year, why are the private collection agencies only collecting 1% when they just testified on average about 8%? If this is and unless my math is wrong, with $752,000 out of $75 million, I think is about 1 million.
Mm-hmm.
1.2%.
About 1%.
So if we're getting them out to them in a timely manner, why is it that we're not collecting this money? Why is this delinquent account continue to grow rather than going the other way, which we thought it would when we passed House Bill 30, whatever it was, in 1999?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, that's a very good question. The filing enforcement is the piece that I wanted to zero in on. That's why I was mentioning to you that specifically, that piece of it. It takes longer for us to collect that, and it would take longer for anyone to collect that, just because of the type of person you're dealing with and the situation they find themselves in. And that's why we're seeing the growth in the accounts receivable for the Department of Revenue. We've actually had discussions with with DAS as to whether or not the filing enforcement, those people who are not actually, have never admitted that they owe this, this is our estimate of what they owe, whether that really counts as a delinquent debt for accounts receivable or not, because it still can be adjusted up or down once they come forward and work with us on it. But that's really where the growth is that $125 million down at the bottom that you see that piece of it. The rest of it, the part where the taxpayer admits they owe the money or it comes through an audit, something like that, we can collect it or else we turn it over very quickly to the private collection agencies, and they have a pretty good collection success rate on that piece as well. Part of the factor, I would think, on what the private collection agencies' success rate is partly they still do have some of that older debt from the Department of Revenue. I'll be honest about it, that we sent some older accounts out there that we had really, the employees really thought they had a good chance of collecting. And they've been trying. And we said, we have the one-year provision. It needs to go out to the private collection agencies. And we weren't able to collect it. And I don't think the private collection agencies are going to have very much luck with it. I know that Mr. Marquis could address that. But once we get a lot of that older debt out of the private collection agencies, their success rate should be going up, too. Because we feel it's a very good partnership that we have with the private collection agencies. They have some different ways of looking at things and doing things and some different avenues that maybe we don't. So we want to use them as partners. And once they work, the backlog is moved out from the Department of Revenue. Now it's some of it's probably out at the private collection agencies. It needs to work its way through there. And then this will be a much more of a flow-through piece of it for the standard kind of collection rates.
Mr. Chair, as you know, I asked for an amendment to be drafted for this bill that would require the turning over of this $340 million instantly to private collection agencies to see how much we can collect between now and June 30th, because I think we could solve a lot of our budget problems in the current biennium if we could actually collect some of the money that's already owed to the state of Oregon. And I was told by legislative counsel through Mr. Dotson that they didn't know that an amendment like that for it would be appropriate or needed for this bill because they said the Department of Revenue was already turning over things after a year. But I guess the question is, if how much of this is less than a year old of the $341 million, or let's talk about the $93 million number, if that's the number you want because the rest is exempt, how much of that is less than a year old, and what percentage could we potentially collect between now and June if we put this in private collection agency? Your own people have said that if we give you $3 million, I think you're going to collect 13 or something like that. I think that if we were to turn over $93 million to private people, I don't think they're going to charge us $3 million, and I bet they can get 13. I'm just wondering if you have a response to that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, the information I've looked at, Mr. Dufresne had a little chart here about what the collection rate was for the all state agencies, and it's about 14%. That was as of, it varies from year to year, but about 14%. And as I mentioned, over time, Department of Revenue does get 97%. I'd be happy to provide you more information about the age, if that would be helpful for you.
I would like to see aging on these accounts because over time, the way I see this number continues to grow. If you're getting 97%, how come this number is still growing?
Mr. Nelson, Senator Beyer, I hate to be repetitious here, but perhaps it would be useful for us to provide information for you that shows you the accounts receivable without the filing enforcement piece. And that might help you, because that's why the accounts receivable is growing, is the filing enforcement, as we add that in. And it takes us longer to collect that piece of it, so it's slowing the collection rate of the total accounts receivable out. But if we take that piece out, we can provide some historical information for you that shows you with the filing enforcement in and then without. And that might be helpful for you to see as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd appreciate that. And I would appreciate an accurate aging on these accounts, specifically the $93 million, but the entire portfolio, if you have that. I'd like to see what we've got here for aging, not just more than a year. I'd like to know 1 month, 6 months, 9 months, okay, and up to a year and beyond a year, because if we have $75 million in debt the private people can't collect because it's so outdated, then we don't want to talk about that. We want to talk about the stuff that's collectible.
Sure. Okay. Senator, Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I'd be happy to provide that information for you.
Thank you very much.
You bet.
Yes.
Just real quickly, so a quick response is fine. Just following on what Senator Beyer's general, theme was here, when you turn a Department of Revenue piece over to a private collection agency, based on the previous testimony, is that also true that they do not have the same powers that the Department of Revenue has to collect in terms of the Attorney General with garnishment, et cetera, et cetera?
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, that's correct. The Department of Revenue does have the ability to issue warrants. We have other tools that you as legislators have given us to collect more difficult type collection cases.
Because that would seem to indicate, at least that would be one reason if I'm a private collector, would make it a little bit more difficult for me because, if the person out there who's been unwilling to pay knows that, and that mm-hmm. this is exactly a kind of a smaller stick. And if I haven't paid revenue with the bigger stick, I'm probably not going to be real receptive to the smaller stick.
Unless
we gave them more tools.
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, one thing might help illustrate that as well is that the Department of Revenue does provide collection services for other state agencies if they wish through our other agency account unit. And they have some of the tools that the Department of Revenue has for its tax programs as well. And their rate of collection is about 8% right now on the accounts. 8%?
8%.
That they're getting from accounts that the other state agencies have already worked. And the state agencies have, after 1 year with no payment, they can send it to private collection agencies, or they can send it to Department of Revenue, other agency account unit. And they have those two avenues to go with. And Department of Revenue, other agency account unit, charges its cost only and gets about 8% return usually for the state agencies. So that's an avenue. And if other agency accounts is not able to collect it, then it goes back to the state agency, and then they send it out to a private collection agency as well. So that's how the statute runs.
John, you've been sitting there pretty quiet. Do you have something to add to all this?
I'm taking notes.
Excuse me.
We're not going
to. I didn't think so. If you don't mind me excusing, I think Senator Perry really needs to be for a quorum in the next committee. So.
Okay, thank you.
Chairman Nelson, I have about six copies of a leftover report from one of our budget meetings that I'd like to share with you. And I think it will help address Senator Beyer's questions about the inventory and how it's proceeding through. Again, for the record, my name is John Frame with the State Controller's Office. As Susan Browning has indicated, and I believe is also accurate on a statewide basis, it took about 1 to 2 years for the aged accounts to make it into the system and start processing through the system. The table we give you here shows the accumulations of the LFO data from 2000, 2001, and 2002. And I'd like to first point out the anomaly in 2001, which is where the Judicial Department began submitting information to legislative fiscal. One of the key points on this that I'd like to bring out, as it shows, the ending inventory under that total inventory section is just down, shows $780 million, $1.094 billion, and $1.156 billion. The total inventory of that liquidated and delinquent accounts is rising. However, if we look at that on the state agency net level, that is, how much of that inventory has been displaced to the Department of Revenue's other agency accounts for collection, and how much has gone out to private collection firms, which again is the thesis behind House Bill 3509, keep these accounts churning, keep them moving, and allow everyone to get an opportunity to collect on them, we believe that that is what's happening. As you notice, the ending inventory actually declines in 2002, indicating that the overall inventory of states accounts has been reduced. That means that more accounts mm-hmm. are now extending out to the Department of Revenue's other agency accounts. And as you notice, the inventory with private collection firms is now triple from the 2000 rate. So they had $80 million available to them for collections in year 2000 and now have $245,774,143 out being collected. So that's one of the actual inventory at the state level let me rephrase that, at the agency level is actually starting to show the first reduction we've seen over this period. However, the overall bulk is still large because there's a large set of accounts out at the private collection firms. Part of this would be the judicial impact
which the Department of Revenue, as you notice, they see them spike in 2001 up to $173 million, but they were able to recover and start, again, processing through that. As I recall, there were some 60,000 accounts that went through the system in a very short period and to be processed. 2002, they returned back to $152 million, so they were able to start processing those accounts. In a strategic plan document that's available on our website, and we share this with a number of legislators already, we analyze some of this detail, and we provide some information regarding how we think the state is doing, how agencies are doing, what we need to do, what we could do better, so on and so forth. We can get you copies of this document if you'd like to see that.
Sure.
Again, at the actual collection rates at the percentage collections down at the private collection firms, as you can see, is 1.83%, 1.42%, and 1.86%. We, in the strategic plan report, again, we analyzed national data provided by the American Collectors Association, and over the last couple of years, we were kind of alarmed at first at the amount that the Department of Revenue and other agency accounts collected at the roughly 8% level and the 2% at the private collection firms. Actually, that's well within the limits provided by the American Collectors Association for what we call first, second, and third placements. If we take these liquidated and delinquent accounts and analyze them as if the state agency would be a first placement where they have a professional collection staff attempting to make that collection, turn them over to the Department of Revenue, which would be a second placement rate, the normal rates for second placements is between 5 and 8%. So the Department of Revenue falls well within those means. If we then take the next step and say what happens if you were to send it out to a third placement, a third private collection entity, those rates vary between 0.6 and 2.5%. So again, the private collections at 1.8% are well within those third placement rates. Now, I'm generalizing, and it doesn't always work like that. Some state agencies go immediately to private collection firms. Mm-hmm. Some use the Department of Revenue. In fact, other agency accounts is a better in-state collection tool than it is an out-of-state collection tool. So the recommendation is if you're doing out-of-state collections, if you know your debtor is gone, then that is the recommendation. That's number one. Number two, other agency accounts works a tax refund offset program. That program can be used simultaneous with private collections. So as we're coming up on the tax period and tax refund checks, well, may or may not be available. there may be some funds people are getting refunds. Those will be available through this tax offset to pay those debts. So that's another opportunity there, to improve some revenue over the short-term period, assuming state agencies have those placed with the offset program. Again, as Susan indicated, our collection rates are declining. On the flip side of this page, it says Oregon Assets Comparisons. One of the other issues that we need to provide a clear demarcation is the receivable with the liquid and delinquent account. This is receivables. This talks about what has happened over the last 7 years with the rate of revenue increasing, but our receivables held pretty constant. That means we have a pretty high rate of voluntary payment, and we have a pretty good rate of first collection efforts. In other words, first contacts seem to get those dollars in. When we start talking about liquidated and delinquent accounts, we're talking about some type of adverse process where you're trying to weigh a due process methodology with due diligence methodology. In other words, these may have to go to courts, these may have to be administrative hearings, these may have to go through judicial processes before we can actually identify them as liquidated. To go back to another statement, sometimes those processes can go out for months or years. Sometimes the person will make payments for a while and then stop making payments. So it is not uncommon to see an account sent out that may be 2 or 3 years old because they went through a judicial process or they were making payments and stopped and skipped out. And at some point in time, when they discover that, we're not getting anywhere with this account, they would turn it over for private collection. So I would expect to see some of those to be, several years old. However, I would say now in this third and starting our fourth year of this process, I would expect fewer and fewer accounts in general to be within those outside of those parameters very far. But there is going to be always some because if they stay in the system. Or maybe they've been in jail for 5 years, they get out, we try to collect for a few months and say, forget it, it's not worth it, we send it out. So that account's already 5 years old, plus whatever months we try to do our own type of collections. A third of these accounts fall in the judicial process, about $330 million. And so certainly that's, the flavor of those accounts is going to be a very low collection versus some of the others.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer had a question earlier a little bit about what's in the accounts receivable. I did just, what John said triggered something for me as well. Individuals who are on pay plans are still within accounts receivable as well. For instance, for the Department of Revenue, we have right now about $18 million worth of accounts that people are on pay plans. And as long as they fulfill their pay plans, they will stay in compliance. We will allow those just to go on. If they break their pay plan, if they miss a payment, then we will shift them back into active collections. But that also gets back to the issue of, as we've seen the economy turning down, more people are unable to pay their debt quickly and in full lately. So we've seen a real rise in the number and amount of pay plans that we're carrying forward, because part of our role as well is to make sure people can maintain their lives and maintain their families while they're still paying their debts. So if they can only afford $75 a month and they can meet that and continue to meet that and pay off their debt within a very reasonable period of time, we will set them up on payment plans. But it does delay the return on the account. It does keep it in accounts receivable longer. And if they do default, and we actively work with them, and they still won't come back in, at some point they may actually be ending up referred to a private collection agency. So there's a whole variation of people within this.
Mr. Chair, is that $18 million reflected still in the 32 that the under collection is, and then the payments would go into that 32, and the beginning balance would include the number that 18, or is that an additional number that's not on this paper?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, the amount of money that actually came in per month from those people would be part of the collections, but they have $18 million total that's down here in the total that still needs to be collected and repaid. But the repayments back in would be part of the $32 million. They're $100 a month, for instance.
The 18 is part of the 321.
Yes,
or the
that's
341,
correct.
No.
Senator Beyer, that's okay. Correct, yes.
And Mr. Chair, one more question. John, you said your collection rates for the different placements, first, second, third. I got the second and third. What was the first, the collection rate for the first agency?
This will be in the book, and I'll be sure you get a copy of that.
Right, yellow book.
We chose this color because we thought if we placed it on a legislative desk, then it wouldn't be lost. It would certainly stand out.
We can still lose it.
Color will blind you.
It's in our appendix, so I'm trying to dig through and find it.
Well, that's okay, Mr. Chair. I can find it when I get the book.
Okay. Very good.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming.
One last point I'll make. It was mentioned earlier before, the write-off rate. And statewide, the write-off rate is 2.4%. So it's a very low rate statewide.
Is that also in your book?
Pardon?
Is that also in your book?
No, but we can make it there.
Thank you very much. And
thank you.
Close the public hearing on this and work with some of these amendments and continue to seek some answer for Senator Beyer's questions and just move forward with it. I guess there's one other question here. Is it, I mean, the due process question, are you adding a fee onto this? How does that affect you from the agency viewpoint?
We've had some just very casual discussions with the Department of Justice. There would certainly have to be some type of liquidating process. When you add a fee, and I believe both the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act at the federal level and under our chapter 697, I believe that is, or 648, will both require a notification. And again, that's the due process issue, a notification, an opportunity to be heard so that they can respond to that. I don't have any firm concepts of that from the Department of Justice, but I would think it would be at least 30 to 90 days in that kind of time frame before you could make sure that they had that opportunity, they could have proper notice and so on and so forth. But that would certainly be a question if the bill passes that we would be working with the Department of Justice on.
Sure. Thank you very much. And
thank
we'll
you.
Close the public hearing and close the public hearing for the whole committee. Thank you.